Why donate to CJSF 90.1 FM's annual fund drive? To help fund independent journalism in a rapidly shifting media landscape. To support local and independent artists in getting invaluable FM airplay they won't get anywhere else. To provide a platform for underrepresented and marginalized voices. To feel awesome about contributing to our community. Be awesome with us. Donate to CJSF 90.1 FM's fund drive now at cjsf.ca/donate.
This is Democracy Now!
They want to depopulate the Gaza Strip completely from the entire population and throw them in the lap of Egypt in the Sinai Desert.
An internal Israeli government document has revealed the Israeli Ministry of Intelligence is recommending the forcible transfer of the entire population of Gaza to the Sinai Peninsula in Egypt. As Israel intensifies its ground invasion and the Palestinian death toll tops 8,500, we'll speak to the Palestinian writer Leila El-Haddad. She is from Gaza, as well as the Israeli historian Ilan Pape. 50 years ago, he fought in the Israeli military during the 1973 Arab-Israeli War, but has since become a leading critic of the Israeli occupation. Then, the United Auto Workers has ended its historic 6-week strike against the big three automakers after reaching tentative new deals.
We have shown the companies, the American public, and the whole world that the working class is not done fighting. In fact, we're just getting started.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United Nations Children's Agency has warned Israel's committing rampant grave violations of human rights against children in the besieged Gaza Strip. On Monday, UNICEF's executive director, Catherine Russell, briefed the UN Security Council on the humanitarian situation in Gaza, warning Israel's assault is killing or injuring more than 420 children in Gaza every day, a number she said should, quote, shake each of us to our core, unquote.
I implore the Security Council to immediately adopt a resolution that reminds parties of their obligations under international law, that calls for a ceasefire, that demands the parties allow safe and unimpeded humanitarian access, that demands the immediate and safe release of all abducted children, and that urges parties to afford children the special protection to which they are entitled.
Palestinian health officials say over 8,500 people, mostly women and children, have been killed over the past 26 days. On Monday, an Israeli warplane bombed the Turkish-Palestinian Friendship Hospital, the only hospital in Gaza for cancer patients. The attack set part of the building on fire and damaged medical equipment, drawing a strong condemnation from Turkey. In the past 24 hours, Israeli air raids have also struck near the European hospital, the Indonesia hospital, and flattened homes in the vicinity of the Al-Quds hospital, where some 14,000 Palestinians are sheltering. Israeli troops and tanks have pushed further into the besieged Gaza Strip after Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu Monday refused to agree to a ceasefire.
Calls for a ceasefire are calls for Israel to surrender to Hamas, to surrender to terrorism, to surrender to barbarism. That will not happen.
Netanyahu's comments came as Hamas released a video showing three Israeli women held captive in Gaza. In the video, hostage Danielle Aloni fiercely criticizes the Israeli prime minister for failing to prevent the October 7th attack. Netanyahu dismissed the video as cruel psychological propaganda. On Monday, Israel said it had freed the Israeli soldier Ori Megadish, who was taken prisoner by Hamas on October 7th. Israeli officials also announced the death of 23-year-old Shani Luke, who was kidnapped by Hamas from a music festival in southern Israel. Al Jazeera is condemning threats by the Israeli army against the family of its Gaza correspondent, Yumna El-Sayed. On Monday, El-Sayed's husband received a call from Israeli forces warning family members to immediately leave their home or be killed in a bombardment. The threat comes just days after an Israeli strike killed 12 family members of Al Jazeera's Gaza bureau chief, Wael al-Dadu, including two of his children and his grandson. Al Jazeera said in a statement, quote, Israel's actions continue with impunity as they attempt to silence the messenger. Democracy Now! Spoke to Yumna El-Sayed last week.
Homes were targeted. Hospitals were targeted. In these same areas that people were asked to evacuate, hundreds of families who had evacuated from the north and from Gaza City were killed in those bombings. When we say there's no safe place in Gaza, we're not lying.
At least 31 journalists have been killed since October 7th across the region, 26 Palestinian, 4 Israeli, and 1 Lebanese. Among the casualties, Reuters visual journalist Aysem Abdullah, who was killed in southern Lebanon October 13th. The preliminary investigation by Reporters Without Borders found Abdullah and the group of journalists he was with were targeted by Israeli forces. RSF said, quote, two strikes in the same place in such a short space of time, just over 30 seconds, from the same direction clearly indicate precise targeting. To see our interview with his friend, go to democracynow.org. In Canada, crowds of protesters Monday led several sit-ins at the offices of parliament members in Montreal and across at least a dozen other Canadian cities demanding an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
We were joined by over 20 office occupations across the country from coast to coast of individuals not affiliated with any one organization, just individuals that represent the vast majority of Canadians who want to see our government taking action on a genocide that is being live streamed. We want an end to the siege in Gaza, and we want to see our federal members of parliament acting on it as decisively as their constituencies clearly are demanding that they do.
Meanwhile, in Toronto, over 100 workers rallied outside the manufacturing plant and global headquarters of the security and defense company INCAS, which produces arms exported to Israel. Protesters are demanding Canada end its weapons trade with Israel, which they say are being used for the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians. In Russia's North Caucasus region, a mob of hundreds of young men stormed the runway of an airport in Dagestan Sunday evening, appearing to search for Jewish passengers on a flight from Israel. Police say they arrested 60 of the rioters. The founder of Telegram said after the attack, the social media platform had shut down the accounts that organized the mob. Dagestan's governor condemned the attack, writing on Telegram, quote, there's no honor in hurling abuse at strangers, searching their pockets, looking for their passports. On Monday, Russian President Vladimir Putin blamed Western spy agencies and Ukrainian agents for the riot. The White House dismissed the claim and condemned Putin for not doing more to condemn the violence. Here in the United States, federal officials say there's been a spike in hate crimes and threats against Jewish, Arab, and Muslim communities since Israel began its assault on Gaza in response to Hamas's surprise attack on October 7th. In New York, the FBI is investigating violent threats against student organizations, Jewish student organizations, on the Cornell University campus. New York Governor Kathy Hochul visited Cornell Monday, promising the state would boost efforts to monitor social media for anti-Semitic hate speech. In Nevada, police have arrested a Las Vegas man who allegedly left voicemail that included anti-Semitic comments and threats of violence against Nevada's Democratic Senator Jackie Rosen, who's Jewish. In Illinois, a 71-year-old landlord accused of fatally stabbing a 6-year-old Palestinian-American boy 27 times pleaded not guilty on Monday to his murder and hate crime charges. The boy's name was Wadia Al-Fayoum. His mother, Hanan Shaheen, was left hospitalized with serious injuries from the assault. The landlord reportedly shouted, "You Muslims must die," during the attack. In Colorado, authorities say a heavily armed man died by suicide before carrying out an apparent planned massacre at an amusement park. Police say the body of the unnamed 20-year-old was found Saturday morning at the Glenwood Caverns Adventure Park wearing body armor and tactical gear. He was armed with an AR-style rifle, a semi-automatic handgun, and explosive devices. In Maine, newly surfaced records show police ignored repeated warnings about threats made by the Army reservists behind last week's mass shooting, which left 18 people dead and 13 others injured. In mid-July, an Army commander was told that Robert Card should not have a weapon, handle ammunition, or participate in live fire exercises. The commander alerted local police, but it's unclear if officers took any action. And just 6 weeks ago, police records show Card punched a friend and stated he was planning to, quote, shoot up the drill center where his Army Reserve unit is based. An officer performed a wellness check on Card but gave up after Card did not answer the door. In Denver, Colorado, opening arguments got underway Monday in a case brought by voters seeking to ban Donald Trump from appearing on the 2024 presidential ballot. Lawyer Eric Olson argued Trump should be removed under the insurrection provision of the 14th Amendment adopted after the Civil War.
Our Constitution prevents people who betrayed their solemn oath, as Trump did here, from serving in office again. Colorado law gives these voters the right to make sure their votes will count by coming to this court and ensuring that only eligible candidates appear on our ballots.
A similar lawsuit is being heard by Minnesota Supreme Court this week. In more campaign news, Mike Pence dropped out of the race, his long-shot bid to win the Republican Party's nomination. Trump remains the front-runner in the race by far, even though he faces 91 felony counts across four criminal indictments. Meanwhile, Minnesota Congressmember Dean Phillips said Friday he'll challenge President Biden for the Democratic Party's nomination in 2024. Phillips has made Biden's age a centerpiece of his campaign, saying, quote, I think it's time for the new generation to rise. The United Auto Workers Monday reached a tentative agreement with General Motors more than 6 weeks after thousands of auto workers walked off the job for a historic strike against the big three U.S. automakers. The deal followed similar tentative contracts the UAW reached with Stellantis and Ford in recent days. This is UAW President Sean Fain.
We have won record agreements at Ford, Stellantis, and now GM. We have united our membership like never before. We have shown the companies, the American public, and the whole world that the working class is not done fighting. In fact, we're just getting started.
The agreement with GM includes a 25% wage increase over 4.5 years, among other benefits. We'll have more on the strike later in the broadcast. And today marks the end of PEN America's inaugural Prison Ban Books Week, which revealed how prison censorship is now the most pervasive form of information suppression in the United States. More books are banned by prisons and jails than the country's schools and libraries combined. There's been a rise in content-neutral bans that require incarcerated people to get books from approved vendors and block free and used literature from family and friends. Prison officials are also citing security and sexual concerns to censor scientific and creative literature. This is Quinetta Harris, an incarcerated nurse and writer in solitary confinement in Texas.
This is what Texas considers sexually explicit, a guide to performing self-breast exams. These are pictures of our bodies to show us how to care for ourselves. Books or magazine articles with contraception, menopause, and general reproductive health care are all denied.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Top United Nations officials are expressing growing alarm over the humanitarian crisis in Gaza, as the enclave's last remaining hospitals are on the verge of shutting down due to a lack of fuel as Israel intensifies its ground invasion while rejecting growing calls for a humanitarian ceasefire. Palestinian health officials say over 8,500 people, mostly women and children, have been killed over the past 26 days. The head of UNICEF said the lack of clean water and safe sanitation is on the verge of becoming a catastrophe. Philippe Lazzarini, the head of UNRWA, the UN agency for Palestine refugees, repeated his call for an immediate humanitarian ceasefire, saying it's, quote, become a matter of life and death for millions.
The current siege imposed on Gaza is collective punishment. 2 weeks of full siege followed by the trickle of aid last week mean that basic services are crumbling. Medicine is running out. Food and water are running out. Fuel is running out. The streets of Gaza have started overflowing with sewage, which will cause a massive health hazard very soon.
In North Gaza, Israel attacked areas next to the Indonesian hospital Monday, where Dr. Moen El-Masri said the staff is struggling to treat patients.
The damage has been caused to more than one area in this unit. The damage has directly led to the disconnection of the electricity line of this unit. As you know, this means no electricity for the patients and injured here, which directly threatens their lives and could lead to the death of many of these patients. In a few hours from now, the power will be cut due to the limited fuel available in the generators. Running out of fuel means power will be cut, meaning certain death for many of the patients in the ICU, some of whom need respirators, as well as patients in the surgical suites, and patients in other units who numbered around 240 or 250.
We go now to Gaza City, where we're joined by Dr. Hamam Alo, who works at Al-Shifa Hospital, the largest hospital in Gaza. Dr. Alo, thanks so much for joining us. I know you've just left the hospital a few minutes ago. You told Jewish Currents yesterday, I had to stop the resuscitation of a patient who went into cardiac arrest in the dialysis unit because if she made it back to life, we had no ventilator to offer her. We have to prioritize patients who are younger, healthier. We have lost the ability to provide true care. If you can talk about the situation right now at your hospital and overall.
Oh, hey, thank you for contacting me. This is not an incident I would really love to keep remembering, but this is what you just said was exactly what happened to me. As physicians, we are trained to resuscitate patients who go into cardiac arrest, hoping they would make it back again to life and consequently put them in ventilators to help them live again, go back to life. But I had to stop my co-nurses and my physicians from doing this. They asked me, why are you asking us to stop resuscitating the patient? It's like you're asking us to kill her. I told them we have no better options. No, we have no wiser choices. Because in case she makes it back to life, we have no ventilators to offer her. And if there is any, we would prevent a younger, healthier, injured patient from entertaining that luxury. I mean the ventilator. So I don't know if you would imagine the amount of regret, the amount of sadness I'm living with since this happened with me, but I'm sorry to say there was no better options to go for except stopping that resuscitation. And if this tells us anything, this tells us how things are really getting worse and worse. I was talking to a journalist an hour ago or so, and he kept asking me, you told me a week earlier that things are bad, and are these now the same because you're telling me things are very bad as well now. I told him, yeah, this was probably a very strange answer from my side because things were really bad 1-2 weeks into war, but now they are getting really worse. We have patients admitted to emergency departments where they shouldn't be admitted, where there should be vacant beds for newcomers, for new patients. We have patients admitted to dialysis unit. You know, dialysis unit is a closed unit where you offer a service, and when you're done with your patients, you close your doors. But we can't do this anymore. We are allowing people to live in the unit, actually. We are admitting now patients who need care other than dialysis patients. The few trucks that were allowed in with aid to Gazan people actually is almost nothing compared to what we need. And there was many of the contents of these trucks that were allowed into Gaza had water, gloves, and gauze, and this is not what we are looking for. We are looking for devices, medications, things of really major help and concern for the for providing real health care for people in need. Number of injured patients is increasing. The number of people with chronic medical illnesses who need regular follow-up and regular maintenance of and the provision of medications is increasing. We are not capable of providing the care other than keeping people dying from death. This is the only thing we can do, and we can't properly provide this care because we are getting we are running out of medications and supply.
Dr. Hamamolo, you've said every day I see a fear in their eyes that I can't do much about. It's very painful. If you have kids, you know how horrible it is not to be able to comfort them, to ensure they're all right, to make them hope for anything beyond living one more day. If you can talk about that in the hospital, which, as you said, is not just a hospital for sick people. Thousands are taking refuge at Al-Shifa and Al-Quds and the other hospitals. And also, we're talking to you as you just left Al-Shifa. How do you comfort your family? What's happening to your family as you're at the hospital?
I tell them at least we still have a house with a door to close. But many thousand refugees, people like us who used to live in dignity, have no longer houses and no doors to close to protect them. They are surrounded by wastewater, by garbage. They don't have adequate continuous supply of clean water to drink. Many of them have a lot of missing members of their families. They don't know if they are alive or not. I tell them at least we still have a house to live in, but they don't have. And surprisingly, my 4 and 5 year old kids, they accept this as a comfort, as a better situation compared to those refugees living. They are living actually in hospitals, but it's not like they are living inside the hospital departments. Many of them do not have enough space to go into hospital hallways, so they are living around the buildings and in the garden. So yeah, surprisingly, my very young kids accept this.
The Israeli military has dropped thousands of pamphlets warning people where you are in northern Gaza to leave. Why don't you go with your family south?
And if I go, who treats my patients? They are not animals. They have the right to receive proper health care.
Doctor,
so we can just leave.
The World Health Organization talked about this issue of telling doctors to leave their patients, choosing your own lives over your patients. Can you talk about that choice, since so many patients can't leave, for example, babies in incubators?
You think I went to medical school and for my postgraduate degrees for a total of 14 years, so I think only about my life and not my patients? I'm asking you, ma'am. You think this is the reason why I went to med school? To think only about my life? This is not the reason why I became a doctor.
Can you talk about what's happening to the hospitals? Just in our headlines today, we talked about, and in the last few days, the attack on the Indonesia hospital. The Turkish hospital is the only cancer hospital. Can you talk about the significance of these places, both as a sanctuary, thousands of people taking refuge, and for patients?
Indonesian hospital is providing health care for over 400,000 citizens in the Gaza Strip. And this part of the Gaza Strip is being split from the rest of the Gaza Strip. If this hospital stops providing care So we are exposing many thousand Palestinian souls to the dangers of disease and death. Turkish hospital, with its very modest capabilities even before war, was the only hospital providing care and medications for cancer patients from around the Gaza Strip. It was airstrike yesterday. I don't know how many patients and healthcare professionals were wounded. And many patients are dying now because they are not safe with their families to go to receive care and to continue their chemotherapy. Ministry of Health has declared 2 hours ago or so that the electricity would be cut off from Ashifa Hospital, the largest hospital representing 40% of the healthcare power in the Gaza Strip, and providing services for many machine-dependent patients, like the ventilated patients and the hemodialysis patients. So if electricity is cut out from this in this hospital, so we are directly deciding those patients are going to necessarily die. Ventilated patients will die in minutes. Dialysis patients will die in hours to days from stopping after stopping their hemodialysis. Many patients are now being treated with the modest supplies we have. Many diabetic patients are now being admitted to the hospital because of their insulin is not being kept in the refrigerator, so it's not working. We ran out of many medications, like antifungal medications. We have a patient who died earlier this week with mucormycosis. This is an invasive, ugly type of fungal infection that killed her because we had no amphotericin to offer her. So my very simple answer to your question is that this thing is coming to so many people in the Gaza Strip in hours to days. If this continues the same way it's going on.
Dr. Allo, the Middle East Eye reports on a baby who died, says his death certificate has been issued before his birth certificate. A one-day-old baby has been killed by Israeli bombing in Gaza. Israel, the military, the government, says that Al-Shifa, your hospital, is Hamas, the site of Hamas command and control. Can you respond to that, Dr. Allo?
I've been working this hospital for over 2 years, and I never saw this. So I'm no lawyer, I'm no attorney, but this is how I'm simply replying. I never saw this for over 2 years. If this is true, I would see at least a clue.
I want to ask you about the shipments of aid coming in. Normally, in normal times, if there's ever a normal time in Gaza, over 400 trucks a day. We're talking about a trickle of trucks now, maybe a dozen, maybe eight in a day. Have you ever seen this aid arriving at the hospital? And can you talk about what you need right now?
Well, that number you just mentioned that was allowed into Gaza Strip is actually what you were referring to. It is nothing compared to what we need, nothing compared to the shortage in supplies, machines, and medications we are in need for. The only thing I came just as I was leaving the hospital today was cartoons of IV fluid bottles. This is the only thing I saw. And I don't really know if this came through the aid trucks in the few couple of days, or that was from the stores of the Ministry of Health. In addition, I happened to ask about in the hospital administration, and what they mentioned that was all about the gloves and gauze. And this is not what we are actually only in need for. This is what maybe the least we care for, the least we are in need for. So this is, again, nothing compared to what we are in need for.